Good morning, Fairfax. We are wrapping up a four-week sermon series about Philippians 4, a certain section of it that we've kind of titled Whatever is Good. To start it off, we had John Vaught at the beginning of the month talk about what it would be like if Christians started living our lives like we've already won, how that perspective shift would change how we deal with problems in life, other people, and the like. Robin came after that and talked about anxiety and worry, and he had a beautiful message about how neither of those are sinful. But if we turn to Christ, that there is power there and that we can overcome those. Jacob last week brought an amazing message about peace and how peace looks different to Christians than it does for the rest of the world. And I needed that, so thank you, Jacob. And now it's up to me. Bring this all together, put the message together, and land this plane. I'm excited to do it. We'll see how it goes. I do ask you to remember that a crash landing is still a landing. So, and finally, before I begin, I do just one more thing. We've talked a lot about hope, about anxiety, about, and you'll hear me talk about positive thinking. All four of us, this church, we firmly understand that there are mental issues out there, that there are physiological issues that may keep you from feeling happy and may keep you from feeling like you can't stop worrying. Don't hear us and think that is a lack of faith. We do want to encourage you to talk to somebody about that if you need that. Do not hear anything we say and just think that you're weak or you're sinning if you can't get over those issues. So we love you and want to support you in any way. Let's start with a prayer. Our most gracious and loving Heavenly Father, God, thank you for this morning. Thank you for breath today, for a worship service, to spend time with one another. God, speak through me, get me out of the way, and just have your words be heard. Lord, I ask that you be with the people in this room who chose to be here. May they be uplifted and built up by time together today. It's in your Son's most holy name we pray. Amen. Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence and anything worthy of praise, think about these things. And as for the things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. In Texas, at county fairs and at the state fair, they have an event where teens compete with one another to try to capture a calf and bring it to the center of the ring to earn a prize, the prize money being college scholarship money. Because in Texas, they'll do anything except for make college free. But in 1998, it was my turn to shine. I had practice. I'd gotten a halter, and this is what you have to do. You have to catch a calf, put a halter on it, and lead it. So I'd been practicing for weeks. I had my strategies all lined out. I had backup plans upon backup plans. I was ready. I was positive. Our poor dog had been captured and haltered so many times that the second I got this out, he would go hide. 1998, my moment. So they start it, and it's kind of like the beginning of a battle scene in a war movie. You know, they rush the calves at the teens, and the teens rush towards them, and they all collide. And then I see Megan's just horrified at this. And so we start it, and during the initial melee, I don't grab a calf. That's okay. I knew that was a possibility. And so I'm looking around for the stragglers, the calves that had escaped the initial conflict. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see our middle linebacker, Ricky Jones, who's huge. He's basically carrying his calf to the middle of the ring. I see another girl, and it's right out of a Disney movie, y'all. Like, she and her calf are skipping and singing to each other to the middle of the ring, and I'm starting to panic. There's no... The calves are all getting taken. I might lose this. And then I see out on the far side of the ring, a straggler. I'm excited. I start sauntering over there. And then I realize why nobody has taken this calf. You know, I think they were one calf short, and so they just threw one of the bulls out there. I'm undeterred, though. I know this is my moment. I jump on him, and I've got him, and he's mine. But then I have to put the halter on, and you can't do that with no hands. You have to release with one hand and start getting it on there. I'm halfway through, and that's when Babe the Blue Ox here realizes his moment and headbutts me. I'm seeing stars, but I know I've got to hold on with all my life. And so I've got a hold of the harness, and he's dragging me around this arena and right into the wall twice. I let go. He slips out of the harness, and I'm lying flat on my back, covered in cow, covered in dirt. And I see somebody else is now, I've got all the fight out of him. I did all the work. Somebody else is just calmly putting the harness on and walking him to the ring. I'm defeated. I don't know if you can pinpoint the moment in a teenager's life when they say, I am through with positive thinking. I'm going to go work for the federal government. But if you could, Philippians 4:8. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever's true, whatever's honorable, whatever's right, whatever's pure, whatever's lovely, whatever's commendable, if there's any excellence in anything worthy of praise, think about these things. At this point, most good sermons, they're going to go through each of those and describe those points, and they're going to find strong biblical examples of somebody who lived that out. I'm going to go a different route. I want to focus on the word think. In my preparation, I thought it'd be really impressive and cool if I could learn all these words in Greek and be able to explain all these words to you. Did y'all know Greek is hard? That didn't happen. But one word did stand out, and I do remember that. It's the word for think. And I'm going to say it wrong because I barely have control of the English language, let alone Greek. But logid somai. It's a word that translates to accounting or bottom line. And then all of a sudden you have my interest now because I'm a government loan officer and accountant by nature. I look at numbers. And now you're implying to me that, hey, at the bottom of this, it's a summation. It's a reconciliation of all these things. And then you have to decide about it. And so now you've got my mind captured. I don't think Paul, when he's talking to people, is going to say, Christians, you all have to have a sunny disposition. He knows that we live in a broken world and that there's things around us that cause us to worry. He knows that I'm never going to be a perky turkey. Thanksgiving. There we go. But he's not telling me I have to do that. Instead, he's saying, look at every situation. Look at all the people you're dealing with. And I want you to find something in there and then make a decision. I want you to find something pure about that person, something good, something excellent about this situation that you can praise and anchor yourself in that. If the rest of it looks terrible, if the rest of that person is horrible, find the good and hold on to it because that's how Christ would see them. And if you can't, if you cannot find anything in a person praiseworthy or a situation just has nothing in it that lets you look at it and say, there is good, I think Paul has something to say about that, and we'll get back to it in just a minute. I also found something else interesting when I was looking at translations of this verse. In the 1995 New American Standard Bible, instead of the word think, they translated it to dwell. And that has been stuck in my brain for a while now. Because what does it mean to dwell in something instead of just think about it? To me, it makes me think of living in something. Makes me think, what would it be like to actually have this as your house? If this set of verses is where you live your life, if it's your home. I don't know if you remember a few years ago, but there was a home decorating trend where people would buy these wooden signs, and they're real cute and pretty, and they would have these great messages on them that said, "In this house, we blank." Beautiful messages like, "In this house, we pray. In this house, we love. In this house, we hug it out. In this house, we root for the Cowboys." And they can't all be winners, but neither can the Cowboys. But so, Alicia had decided that maybe it was time for our house to have one, you know, and then she struggled, you know, what would be the mantra of the Nault house? What message would convey to people when they saw that sign that, hey, this is what we believe in? She gave up that search. She couldn't find anything that really met her needs. And I asked her, if you ask her, hey, what did you want that sign to say? She said she was really looking for one that said, "In this house, we flush." 6 years later, we're nearly there. We still have a certain young lady who's about 50-50 on that, but most of us are there. Friends, what would it look like if we actually lived in these words? If we dwelled in these words, if we spent our life working on that? I think it would change how we see people. I think it would look a lot like how David talked in the 23rd Psalm when he said, "You prepare a table in the presence of my enemies, but you anoint my head in oil and my cup overflows." Certainly, goodness and faithfulness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David, no stranger to harsh life, instead knew that there was going to be times he would be surrounded by enemies, but he would dwell in the Lord. Philippians 4, chapter 9, or verse 9, sorry, chapter 4, verse 9. "As for the things you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you." Paul closes out this section by saying, look to him, hear his words, study his actions, be like him. Jacob touched on this a little bit last week. Paul is writing this message from prison, not typically the place you associate with people who are winners or people who would be telling you, live like me. This too can be yours. And honestly, you know, had it been Lee instead of Timothy that he had dictated this to, I might have, you know, hey, Paul, are you sure that's kind of how you want to word this? Let's rephrase that. It sounds a little arrogant. Look to me, be like me, live like me. But here's the thing. Paul spent his every breath, every action pointing to Christ. Everything he did was a reflection of Christ. I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who lives, but Christ who lives in me. To live is Christ, excuse me. Paul didn't teach Paul's story. He taught people Christ's story. And so when he says, be like me, live like me, he's saying, follow Christ's example, be like Christ. He could have chosen 100 different words in verse 8 of good things for us to look for. But it doesn't matter what he chose, because what he's telling us, if there is anything Christ, think about that, dwell on that. And then to end it all, Paul promises the peace of God will be with us. And we talked about it a little bit last week, it's a different kind of peace. I don't think Paul was saying to us, live like this and there'll be an absence of conflict. He wasn't saying we'd be free from people that frustrate us, that we would not be aware of bad things going on. He's promising a peace in a different way. I think it's a similar peace that Christ speaks about in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, blessed are the peacemakers. He's calling us to bring that peace to other people. I just mentioned David, the 23rd Psalm. Did you catch it there? Where he said, goodness and faithfulness will follow me all the days of my life. You know, it wasn't that goodness and faithfulness led David places. No, they followed him because he brought those virtues. And I think that's the same thing God is saying through Paul to us. If there is a situation where you cannot see good, a person that has nothing praiseworthy about that person, they're saying, it's time to go become that. Go bring my peace to that situation. Get involved. Get involved with that person and bring my peace to them. Appreciate Austin leading the song, There is a Habitation. I didn't know we sang it a month ago. I must have missed that. But I'd asked him to lead that again because it reminds me of growing up. It was a song we sang a lot. And I love that song. You may have missed it if you were late. Just a reminder, church starts at 9 a.m. But again, thank you, Austin, for leading that. I think I've been singing that song with a wrong heart for a lot of time, for a lot of years. It's a song where I sing about being in heaven, being free from wars, free from badness, what that would look like. Instead, I think I need to sing it, when will Zion come dwell in me? Call God to come dwell in me and let me go be the habitation for everybody else. Let me be that home. I think about our missionary partner, Bonnie Smith, who her work in the Dominican, she's in some rough situations and she meets some people that you wouldn't look at and say there's goodness to be found in those people. But Bonnie finds it. And when she can't find it, she brings it. I think about the NORADs, our friends here, who spend so much time and energy traveling the world, looking for stories in other countries where they can bring Christ to people, where they can encourage local communities. If you want to know about their work, please come find me and I'll connect you with them because they are living this. You know, great platitudes, Lee. These are great words, but what does it look like? How do I actually do this? How do I become Christ-minded and look for that in other people? You know, I don't know. It'd be a lot better sermon if I did. But I do have two things that I'll share with you that I've done that have been helpful to me. First, get to know God. My father-in-law was visiting last month and we were talking about this sermon. And he said, you know what? I think a book would be really helpful for your preparation. And it's called The Good and Beautiful God. It came out probably 10 years ago. I'm sure many of y'all have read it who are much more readers than I am. But there's a whole series now. But I did what every good son-in-law did. You know, I acted interested in his advice. And then later on, I actually took it without telling him I was going to take it. So, you know, that's how we work. I didn't get past the opening chapter before I found a gem that talks about, you know, it struck me as a way to think about how Christ can help us change our mindset. The quote is, Jesus understood how to people change. That's why he taught in stories. He used narratives to explain his understanding of God and of the world. And if we adopt Jesus' narratives about God, we will know God properly and the right actions. We change not by mustering up our own willpower, but by changing the way we think. My son Jericho, sometimes will be in the car and he'll ask me for a story. Something like, hey, tell me about pets you had growing up. Or, hey, Dad, tell me what a cattle drive is. My wife once complimented him saying, you know, it's really sweet that you are so interested in your dad's background and learning more about him. To which he replied, no, not really. I just sometimes forget to bring a book, and Dad's stories are better than his chase in music. If we're going to know God's stories, we've got to read the Bible. And I know it sounds easy to say my recommendation is read the Bible, but it is. And maybe it's how we read the Bible. I was struck by something that Jen Busby shared in our Bible class a few weeks ago. Again, it probably wasn't profound to her, but it was to me. She said that she now studies with a heart that asks God to teach me something about you, instead of reading her Bible to learn something about herself. And I just thought about that. And, you know, it's true. Oftentimes I'm looking for an answer. I'm looking to learn something that I can apply to me. But instead, maybe I need to be listening to God's story to learn more about God and learn God that Jesus talks about. Second, I changed what media I consume online. About a month ago, I was looking at my phone and I realized how much time I spent on websites that were negative, where I would read what other people were talking about horrible ideas and just angry at each other. And then even dumber, I would read the comments underneath to see what people agreed with me. And I was angry a lot, angry at people I didn't know for opinions that I don't know why they had them, and about situations I couldn't even control. I was spending a lot of my life in that place. And I thought about it and said, you know, if I'm going to allow more time to get to know God, this is not the way. So I started putting my phone away more. Not a few days later, I'm on the metro train going to DC, and there's a gentleman, and he was having, we'll say, a mentally difficult morning. He's stomping up and down the aisle, loudly muttering that there's no seats for him because they're all taken. Lee of 2 months ago would have been buried in my phone and maybe not even noticed. But I was more present, and I noticed that he was having trouble with this situation. And honestly, there were lots of seats open, so I don't know exactly why he didn't feel there was one for him. But I made eye contact, and I motioned that he could have my seat, thinking that that would, you know, maybe be an option. And he bounded over, and before I could get up, sat right next to me. And loudly exclaimed to the whole train, "Thank you for giving me a seat." And then, you know, my urge again is, let's go hide in my phone while this person is next to me. But I resisted. I was like, I need to be open to this situation. This is God. So I turn, I smile at him. I give all the signs that I am there. I am ready to talk if he wants to, you know, discuss his morning with me. And I'm due. I smile, I nod. He doesn't say anything. A few minutes later, I do it again. He doesn't say anything. At the next stop, he pats my knee, stands up, and loudly proclaims to the whole car, "Thank you for giving me a seat, but you're kind of creepy, so I'm going to get off." Not the best start to my journey to be more present. But over the last month, by being more present, y'all, I have seen things I would have missed. Sometimes weird, sometimes not great, sometimes amazing, beautiful scenes. And I would have missed them all. And in all of them, I found Jesus. Which brings me back to this. The halter, it's important for livestock. Because when you control the head of an animal, you can kind of control where they're going to go. And you're welcome for the picture of the cutest calf ever. But once you control that, you can lead an animal. And guys, we're not that much different from animals. When Jesus is in control of our head, our mind, he's going to lead us where he wants us to go, instead of where we want to go. And the peace of God is going to follow. 10 years ago, I had a friend who asked me to preach for him. He was preaching at a small church in Maryland. And he asked if I could cover for him. And so I excitedly called my mom and said, "Hey, I'm going to preach." And she asked, "Do you have a topic?" I said, "Yeah, he asked me to preach on something specific." She said, "Oh, okay, that's nice." She said, "If you get a chance and you can pick your topic, I think you need to preach on something good about Christians who can focus on hope, on joy, because I really think the world needs more joy and hope and Christians that think that way. I'm 7 years too late delivering the sermon for her to hear it. But her point, I think, is more relevant than ever, y'all. And I hope she would be proud.